This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak to the attorney who helped secure the early release of former Air Force linguist and leaker, Reality Lee Winner. Winner had been sentenced to more than 5 years in prison for sharing a classified report detailing Russian hacks of U.S. elections. Historian Eric Christensen joins us to talk about the politicization of history.
It was Karl Marx that observed that the ideology of the ruling class is the ruling ideology. This is what Eric Christensen documents.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Former NSA contractor Reality Lee Winner was released on good behavior from a Texas prison on June 2nd. In 2017, listeners will recall that Winner became the first person prosecuted during the Trump administration on charges of leaking classified information. She was sentenced to 5 years and 3 months in prison, of which she served 4 years. The 29-year-old will ultimately be transferred to home confinement prior to her full release from custody in November. Winner, a former Air Force linguist, leaked a top-secret report. It detailed hacks by Russian intelligence operatives against U.S. election officials and a company that sold voter registration software. She sent it by mail to the online publication The Intercept. Given the document's significance, Intercept staff sought to authenticate it before reporting on it. Their process of identification, however, turned out to be deeply flawed because The Intercept sent a PDF scan of the hard copy report to the NSA's Public Affairs Office, which contained clues that led the government to discover Ms. Winner's identity. Reality Winner then entered a guilty plea to a single felony count of unauthorized transmission of national defense information in 2018 after being prosecuted for leaking that information. Joining us to talk about Reality Winner's recent release from prison is her attorney, Allison Grinter Allen. Allison, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Reality Winner has been called by some an unlikely leaker when compared to other whistleblowers such as Ed Snowden and Chelsea Manning. What did Reality do to get arrested?
Well, I don't know how you qualify who is likely and unlikely to leak information. She released information that she believed should be public. And in fact, it was very essential that we know the details of election interference. But to your question, what did she do? She released an intelligence briefing anonymously to The Intercept that detailed the specifics of Russian interference with election systems manufacturers, direct interference with election systems manufacturers. And that leak led to, well, a lot of things. A public understanding of how great the problem had become, that it wasn't just, as Don Jr. had said, just a bunch of fake Facebook posts. And it also led to a lot of good change being made in our election infrastructure.
Now, her sentence was harsh when compared with other recent leakers. CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling, for example, was sentenced to 30 months for giving classified information about a covert operation against Iran to New York Times reporter James Risen. CIA officer John Kiriakou also got 30 months for sharing the identity of a CIA colleague with the press. Why was Reality's sentence longer? And do you think it had anything to do with the government portraying her as an insider threat, saying things like she had said she hated America and it was the worst thing to happen on the planet?
Right. So Reality was not in prison because she revealed the truth in this intelligence briefing. She was in prison because the truth embarrassed the president at the time. She was made an example of and, you know, demonized in ways big and small because the truth really needed to be discredited in the eyes of the administration. I mean, the big lie didn't just begin last November. We were groomed to accept it with countless smaller lies that began even before Trump took office. Prosecuting reality, making an example of her, that was an important early step in that campaign. We had to be groomed to reject the truth. And demonizing the people who bring us the truth was a very big part of that.
Allison, correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that the Department of Justice arrested Reality Winner an hour after The Intercept published the story of the Russian hacks, which to me seems to set a record. Now, because The Intercept had actually showed the leaked report to the NSA prior to publishing it, do you think the government was tracking Reality down and waiting for that moment of official publication before arresting her?
Oh, I can't really, I mean, I can't speak to the internal machinations at the DOJ or the FBI as far as timing with publication. But I can say that the publication was the problem. It was people knowing the truth of Russian election interference, for sure. Now, you say, like, when was she arrested? The attorneys in your audience will know that that's kind of a moving question. It depends on who you ask. She was interrogated in her own home by 11 FBI agents, 9 of them armed, and she was interrogated with a pretty classic Reed method interrogation in her own home in order to step around her Miranda rights. This was a consensual encounter in her own home. She was free to leave. Jim Comey made it very clear in a public statement later, if she had decided to leave, she wouldn't have gotten 5 steps. So a coerced confession, and her rights were never going to be honored. This was a really targeted, very aggressive prosecution from the outset.
Allison, in recent espionage cases, prosecutors have successfully argued that the leaker's intent is irrelevant. Can you comment on that and motivation to do really a public service, not only by Reality, but other whistleblowers? Do you think she was aware that her intent wouldn't mitigate her sentence if she were caught?
So I want to speak to this idea that in previous espionage cases, as you began your question, in espionage cases, in actual espionage cases, I think that the law is written justly. If you are giving troop positions to a hostile foreign enemy who will then use that information to murder Americans, yeah, your intent should not matter. I mean, in cases of actual espionage, a lot of people are under real duress, but when actual national security is on the line, you know, that shouldn't really be that much of, we shouldn't be really reaching into intent or the actor's mental state. But that's not what this was. This was a release of confidential information, that may have been an abuse of the classification system to begin with, but that's aside the point. And it was not espionage. She gave two American citizens, to the American public, information that belonged to the American public. To call it espionage, to use the Espionage Act of 1917, was an offense to begin with. I mean, it was a way that they could demonize the truth teller here. The Espionage Act of 1917 should not be used for leaks of information to the press. Press leaks are and always have been one of the most important backstops of American transparency and safety. When our government uses the classification system and politically and wrongfully, leaks are what keeps us safe. It's what keeps us free. And it always has been.
Reality was a highly trained cryptolinguist who, from what I've read, likely helped translate communications so drone operators would know who to target. And she received commendations for helping to geolocate enemy combatants, aiding in enemy captures, and removing enemies from the battlefield. But at the same time, she was, from what I've read, from a very early age, also a humanitarian. Can you speak to that?
Reality is, and I've gotten to know her very well, Reality is incredibly empathetic. And she joined the armed forces because she believed that her skills, she is incredibly gifted at language, and that gift could be used to make the world better. She wanted to make people safer and impact people's lives, and she believed that the military was the best way to do that. She wanted to give the kind of intelligence to the American efforts that would help us understand people and advance the cause of democracy and freedom. She comes from a small town in South Texas, and military service is seen all around her community as one of the highest pursuits that a person can go for.
I wonder if recent events over the last few months, including the storming of the Capitol building in D.C., had any impact on her early release. Do you think the Biden administration put what she did in the larger context?
No. Reality has been released to home confinement as part of the normal process of residential reentry. No special treatment has been given to her. No consideration has been made as of yet. And in some ways, we're frustrated by that. But like so many people, I don't think anybody would question President Biden's heart or his motives. But he took on quite a big job, really. And the country that he took the helm of in January was on fire in many different sectors. And Reality, I believe, should be pardoned. And we will continue to advocate for pardon. But we understand if it takes a while, because once-in-a-lifetime pandemic and an economic crash, an insurgency, and all manner of things to set right. It's a lot on somebody's plate. But I feel like a pardon for Reality will be one of the necessary first steps in real healing for the country. If we're gonna heal this sharp divide, we really need to forgive our truth tellers. We need to acknowledge and accept the truth.
Allison, if you don't mind sharing with our listeners, how did you become involved in this case?
So I have another client, Crystal Mason, who was convicted of illegal voting in Texas in the 2016 election. She voted, she cast a provisional ballot, rather, while she was on supervised release, and she was sentenced to 5 years in prison for that. Reality and Crystal Mason were imprisoned together. They met in the media room in their cell block, watching the news, both of them watching the events of the Trump administration play out, and knowing that they were both in prison, essentially for creating anxiety about the legitimacy of the 2016 election in one man's eyes. And they became friends. And when Reality needed an attorney to start the pardon process and the commutation process, Crystal sent my name to her family, and we became friends.
In our few remaining minutes, can you tell us what prison was like for Reality, especially because she was there, as you mentioned, during the COVID pandemic?
I don't think that there's ever a really good time to be in prison, but Reality really, really went through it this past 4 years. The Reality is a fitness fanatic, and outdoors, fresh air, and running give her a lot of comfort. And the COVID pandemic saw her locked basically in her cell block for in the cell dorms for essentially 15 months. And of course, also through that was the freeze and the power instability. Her cell lost power, lost heat. Women had to scrape frozen feces out of the toilets by hand because everything was frozen. It was monstrously torturous. She is not alone in having suffered that. Prisoners were incredibly vulnerable to COVID-19. Reality, of course, contracted COVID-19. Women around her died of COVID-19. It's a very, very scary time to be in an American prison.
In our last couple of minutes, we understand it's going to be many months for Reality to reacclimate to life outside prison. But do you know if she has any plans for the future?
I'm not asking her the kind of long-range future questions right now because I feel like it might stress her out. But I would be really surprised if advocacy and activism didn't play a real part in her life. Reality is nothing if not an advocate. She takes on the concerns of other people. That's how she heals herself. Is she worries about other people's problems. And I would be very surprised if advocating for incarcerated people or voting rights or election security were not paramount in her future plans.
How can our listeners get involved in Reality Winner's case going forward in terms of clemency or other initiatives?
Well, basically, the only thing we can do right now is raise awareness and press the Biden administration to consider a pardon for Reality. That's really the only thing that can be done. We're at the end of legal process, and the only solution right now is an executive action. So I would ask listeners to call their elected officials to talk about Reality's case, to talk about the interference in the 2016 election, and the fact that the only person who did any substantial time for interfering and undermining our election is the woman who told us about it.
Yes, and I think it's important to remind people that just because reality has been released, this case is far from over and is also bound to repeat itself with other people of conscience having the bravery to come forward as she did. Allison, I also want to say that because you have represented reality, both of you are now in Law and Disorder's pantheon of heroes. How can our listeners follow you on social media?
Absolutely. Well, I am at Allison Grinter, one L in Allison, on Twitter. I would welcome anybody to come and be Twitter friends with.
And we'd love to have you back on to celebrate when reality is pardoned.
Thank you. I really love that.
Thank you so much, and have a wonderful day, Allison.
Thank you. You as well. Thanks for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
There's no shortage of aphorisms about history repeating itself when leaders fail to learn from their prior mistakes. While a thorough grasp of history is no guarantee that things will go smoothly in the future, it can help gain insight about current conditions and can inform future actions. But history is vulnerable to manipulation. Never stagnant, always subjective, history is constantly being reshaped, especially by those with the resources to do so. According to Professor Eric Christensen, as new channels of mass communication emerged on the heels of World War II, elite communities in the media, commerce, and government mined examples from history to create their own propaganda. Through a range of techniques, aided greatly by television, they advanced their respective agendas, from commerce to politics. In his book, Channeling the Past, Politicizing History in Postwar America, by the University of Wisconsin Press, Christensen presents a history of what he calls the usable past. He examines several sources of purposely politicized history that put themselves forth as credible citizens' history, adapted for the new age. Joining us today is Eric Christensen, Professor of History and Public History Coordinator at Rhode Island College. Eric, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi, and thank you, Michael. A pleasure to be here.
Eric, you've written that, quote, popular history boomed in this country in the mid-20th century. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you know, in the book, I use the term popular history to talk about interpretations of history that really were intended for a broad public, a broad audience. And these could be done in a lot of different ways, and through books, through radio, TV, museum exhibits, etc. But in my mind, these were also intended to be taken seriously by the public, you know, as history. And yes, I think there was a boom in popular history in the middle of the last century, and there's a lot of commentary at the time that, you know, that suggests that was true. So, for example, the historians who start the History Book Club in 1947 did so because they noticed this. They saw that there was a great interest in reading history, and they wanted to respond to that and shape that. There's also, we can see a lot of support for increasing history in schools, and there's high ratings in history-themed radio or television shows. We can also look at, you know, Disneyland and Davy Crockett and Frontierland and the ubiquity of Hollywood Westerns in this period. You know, and I can go on and on. So, you know, long story short, a lot of people commented on this and certainly made note of it at the time. One of the really popular historians of that period, Daniel Boorstin, noted that Americans, more than he thought other people, tended to rely on history and use this kind of historical American way of life that would substitute for any kind of political theory for most people. And he came up with this idea that I really love still, this notion of American givenness, this idea that Americans tend to think of our values as a sort of gift from the past. In other words, that like the founding fathers kind of just gave us this perfect and complete political system that would be ideal for all of our future needs, so that Americans tend to then look to the past rather than to ideology or political theory to talk about what's possible in the present or in the future. And I think that's sort of obviously true when we think about, you know, are new laws going to be constitutional or are they going to be unconstitutional? But it's broader than that. It's, does this fit into the American tradition? Does this keep with the American way as we understand it? And if not, then, you know, there's this tendency, I think Boorstin is right, there's this tendency then to reject things that don't seem to fit. So a lot of people noted this interest in history at the beginning of the atomic age, this age of increased anxiety, and people seem to be turning to history more and more for some kind of answers, some kind of direction. But I don't mean to suggest that this meant that people were necessarily turning to historians or books. They were often using easier ways to access the past, radio, TV, movies, for example. And so it was kind of history for the common people, but definitely not, for the most part, a people's history, right? It was history created by elites and created them to, by them, to support their own political or economic objectives.
One of the college courses you teach focuses on films as a primary source of information about 20th century U.S. history. In Channeling the Past, you don't discuss Hollywood movies or theme parks, but you note that both presented similar and contending versions of the past. What do you mean by this? And can you give some examples of how both deal with history?
Sure. Yeah, that's right. In the book, I make the distinction between things like Hollywood movies and theme parks that sometimes would present a version of the past to the public, but clearly were intended mostly for entertainment purposes. And then on the other hand, you have these radio, TV series, or other endeavors that certainly were meant to hold people's attention and interest them, but the primary motive wasn't entertainment. It was education or perhaps indoctrination. So as you know, I focus on the latter in the book, but there's no doubt that everyone, you know, myself included, we have our ideas about history, about the past, shaped by popular TV shows, movies, and, you know, I think theme park creations, whether that's, you know, going through Disney's Frontierland or Main Street or large parts of Dollywood and other theme parks that have a large historical element to them. And I think that for the most part, these have been conservative visions of the past, safe visions of the past designed to appeal to the greatest number of consumers. And I think, you know, too, we all know this, that in recent years we've seen some changes. We've seen film and TV depictions of history get more complex and give us a much more accurate picture of the past, which is not to say that everyone appreciates that change, certainly. But back in the 40s and 50s, Disney's Main Street, for example, you know, offered a very clean-cut, very whitewashed version of American history. America was always good. Americans were pretty much always white. Progress was continuous. and the past was mostly idealized, so there were few, if any, major problems that needed to be addressed. Mostly, as I said, that the past was used as a nostalgic setting for entertainment purposes in these cases. And so the book instead focuses on other kinds of sources that really were deliberately trying to teach history and present themselves as history to the public.
Eric, you referred earlier to the History Book Club. What was that, and what is its relevance to the politicizing of history?
Yeah, the History Book Club is really interesting to me. And it was launched in 1947, and the idea behind it was to use professional historians and their expertise to guide people, a group of people, really, that they talked about sometimes as the small town intelligentsia, teaching them how to learn about American history through their book club selections. So you had this group led by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Bernard DeVoto. It also included his young colleague Arthur Schlesinger Jr. And three others of their close friends and associates. And they put together the reading list, as they saw it. They deliberately chose books that would challenge the first members of the History Book Club. They were long books. They were dense. You know, I've read a number of them. They're really not easy books to get through. And the books were also very critical about the United States and critical in their approach to U.S. history. Politically, they're really quite liberal, very progressive, certainly didn't shy away from labor conflicts or racism, economic issues, and especially environmental issues, which is a major concern of Bernard DeVoto's in the 1950s, too. And the idea was, with the club, they thought that if they could just get people to read good history, you know, well-researched, well-written history, then Americans of that age would be better equipped to deal with a host of contemporary issues, from the Cold War to growing corporate power, another one that DeVoto and Schlesinger particularly were very concerned about. So they had this idea for the club, and it lasted for maybe about a year before the business side of the book club forced some changes that the historians just didn't find acceptable. In short, what happened was that instead of selecting books based on the historians' objectives, you know, to provide the best in new history that was written and to help people make sense out of their world today, the club shifted to just looking for books that they thought were likely to be popular, you know, that would attract new members to the club and make it into a successful business operation, with very little concern about the quality of the work they were selecting. And so, you know, the club became nothing more than a discount bookseller and lost that original sense of purpose, became less overtly political, probably, but certainly also more conservative. Again, you know, in the sense that the selections were cautious, they didn't want to offend anybody or challenge their pre-existing ideas about history, but I think also conservative in the more political sense, too. And the progressive politics that underlay the History Book Club's beginnings disappeared with the resignations of the original five historian slash board members. The people that replaced them were happy to just lend their names to the club for publicity, but followed instead of leading the club's direction going forward.
A fascinating chapter on DuPont's program. It first appeared on radio, then on TV, called Cavalcade of America. And you contend that it helped define who belonged in the American story. Can you talk about how the series, what its primary objectives were?
Sure. I think, you know, a key point that I hope I make clearly in the book is that the Cavalcade series that DuPont sponsored, I think, had two pretty broad objectives. And one of these was to create a very rosy picture of American history that indicated to the public that there was no, you know, no need for substantial criticism or correction or popular social movements or anything like that, because things were more or less okay, right? And the second big objective was to transform large corporations, big business, into the heroes of American history. And in the process, DuPont, over 20 years, more than 20 years, told Americans each week who belonged in the great cavalcade of America and who could be left out, who should be forgotten. And so they kind of put together this, you know, hall of heroes almost over 20 years. So the goal of making big business in general, and DuPont in particular, into this driving force behind American progress, they thought was necessary because DuPont had, by the mid-1930s, become one of the least popular large businesses in the United States. They were known as the merchants of death in the 1930s after Senate hearings that investigated the company's involvement with World War One, and so they also faced, of course, FDR's administration and the New Deal, and as the New Deal was gaining steam in the mid-30s, that's when DuPont launched the Cavalcade of America to fight against it and to fight against government regulation, higher taxes, with these histories, these stories that illustrated all the benefits of bigness, of free enterprise, and on the other hand, of small government and of no labor unions, you know, in their factories. So in other words, they would provide historical evidence through these shows that the New Deal was completely unnecessary, it was unprecedented in American history, it was, you know, antithetical to the American way of life, dangerous to the American way of life even. It didn't fit in the past as DuPont presented it on the show, and so it wasn't appropriate for the present. You know, the company had discussed with NBC Radio in 1935 how they could get the public to swallow its propaganda. I mean, they used those words. And they talked about that, you know, perhaps they could do this by disguising it as history lessons. And frankly, from the company's perspective, it worked beautifully. A public that just absolutely loathed DuPont in the mid-1930s came to love DuPont, and it, you know, it was one of the most admired companies in the post-war era. And public schools and colleges used episodes of Cavalcade of America to teach history in the classroom. I think I might have said this before, but it was a very highly rated show, and teachers who required, you know, in total millions of students across the country to watch it each week certainly contributed to those high ratings. So just to maybe mention a couple of representative examples of specific episodes, because, you know, as I say in the book, the individual episodes really follow a pretty clear pattern, and over the 20-year run of the series on radio and TV, you see the same themes repeated time and time again. But just a couple of examples, there was a post-war episode, I think maybe 1947, called The Forge, which starred Ronald Reagan as a man named Ephelet Remington. And Remington Arms was a DuPont subsidiary, and it's a gun, you know, weapons manufacturer. And in the history on Cavalcade, Remington apparently created this company back in the early 19th century because he felt he had this calling and this duty to provide his fellow Americans with guns and to help them tame the frontier, you know, kill Native Americans, and grow the nation. So the businessman acts here in the public interest, not in any kind of self-interest. And the modern-day corporation, you know, is just representing the success of that early founder. So this is, as I said, just a representative example. Most of the, or many of the episodes followed a very similar kind of storyline. I also wanted to mention that, you know, these episodes were promoted by DuPont, but they're also promoted by related companies, related trade associations or industry groups. So, for example, obviously Remington Arms promoted that show. Other shows about the discovery of oil would be promoted by the oil industry, and they would get local TV stations in their news broadcasts to air stories to help promote the episodes. They would insert stories into newspapers, including, you know, national papers like the New York Times. They would get the films made and distributed to public schools. So it was, you know, it was quite a massive operation that went well beyond DuPont itself. But the point of those oil discovery episodes was similar. It was, you know, you had these moments of discovery that I think made for pretty good television. You had the, you know, exploding oil wells and that kind of thing. But the point there was that these individuals it discovered the fields, but then it was the large corporations that followed that managed the, you know, the extraction, the refinement, the distribution to consumers. And so the lesson was, you know, these modern day corporations are doing the work, and they are best left alone to do the work, because they are the only, you know, entities that can handle this kind of thing. So the other objective I mentioned, which was to idealize the American past, went hand in hand with presenting big business as this kind of benevolent force in history. And the series frequently had to refute arguments for breaking up trusts, breaking up monopolies, and they tried to kind of naturalize their existence by putting them again into history. They would show that these businesses had grown organically, they had succeeded because they provided for the public good, you know, and so there was no need in the present, you know, say the 1940s, for example, for any kind of antitrust, you know, lawsuits, which DuPont faced repeatedly in the Truman years especially. There was no need for labor unions, and of course DuPont, you know, had to repeatedly work very hard to prevent labor unions in their factories. You know, these were constant concerns, and they would address these concerns through the history lessons on Cavalcade. I also think it's interesting, you know, this to my mind connects with this fight today that we see against objective or critical history, and this current conservative idea that, you know, we don't want to look too critically at the past because everything really is fine. There's no need for protest. There's no need for restitution, certainly not reparations. You know, I think it was just a couple of days ago, I heard Mike Pence say that systemic racism in America is a left-wing myth, right? It's not, there's no reality behind systemic racism, according to Pence. And I'm sure, you know, we've all seen these Republican bills and governor's executive orders across the country that would prohibit teaching about slavery and would require so-called patriotic history. And I think what my book really shows is that patriotic history, you know, that's not a new term. That's always been this ideological or political position that was used to defend the powerful and powerful companies, powerful families, against charges that their power was built, you know, on a foundation of exploitation or any kind of unfairness. You know, of course, it's better for the powerful to keep the skeletons in the closet, so to speak. And so, for example, you know, DuPont, which, as I said, was exposed in the 1930s in these congressional hearings as merchants of death, they turned around then and created this model for patriotic history, this uncritical version of the American past that seems to be, you know, in high demand by the Republican Party and, you know, conservatives more generally now again in 2021.
Eric, you devote a chapter to what you call the Freedom Train, which carried dozens of historical documents around the nation in 1947 and 1948 so that people in all 48 states could see the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and more. The American Heritage Foundation was the organization behind this campaign, which you describe as propaganda. How was this propaganda?
Well, I think this is another story of corporate America taking over this role of teaching history to the public. They get this opportunity because they offer to pay for it, and that's hard to turn down. So, you know, we saw this with DuPont giving schools episodes of Cavalcade to play in their classrooms, and it's a similar story with the Freedom Train, which initially was developed by civil servants in D.C., and it was proposed to contrast American democracy with fascism and to really focus in on civil liberties and what that meant for ordinary American citizens. But Congress, as much as they loved the idea, didn't want to pay for it. And so a group of business leaders stepped in and they made this into a propaganda campaign. So the idea was, you know, expose as many people across the country as possible to 126 documents that were put on the train. And then somehow people would learn from history, even though they could only spend about 10 seconds, as it turned out, in front of each document. So really the point was to get Americans to participate in this kind of civil religious ceremony that the American Heritage Foundation, this group of business leaders, called Rededication Week. And each city that hosted the train across the country had to have one of these rededication weeks as part of the deal. And so the week's activities would focus on the word freedom, but you know that word freedom was mostly defined in the end by this big business group, the American Heritage Foundation, and they mostly meant free enterprise, you know, unrestricted capitalism. And so this group overlapped with the Ad Council, which came out of the War Advertising Council in World War II, and, you know, which helped with promoting World War II, but also promoted business interest more or less in the guise of public service. And that kind of continued then through the American Heritage Foundation and the Freedom Train campaign in the post-war years. So you had this campaign to promote national unity, democracy, faith in democracy, and it certainly was that. They encouraged teaching civics in schools. They provided educational materials to teachers, you know, et cetera. But as I said, the corporate sponsors really were more interested in holding up this train full of documents to prove that freedom depended on free enterprise and letting companies alone to do what they wished. And it was hard to argue against that interpretation when people could only glance at these documents for a few seconds. You know, they more or less had to accept the interpretation that the Heritage Foundation put forward.
Eric, we've unfortunately come to the close of our allotted time, but in our last couple of minutes, tell us what you're working on now and how our listeners can learn more about your work.
Well, in terms of my historical research, I've been writing about the first undocumented immigrants to be designated as refugees by the United States, which happened in the mid-1930s, and it gave them a legal residency in the U.S. and a path to citizenship. And I'm finding their stories to be just absolutely fascinating, not least because nearly all of them entered the U.S. illegally, and yet the U.S. Congress sought to protect them, even while the Congress at the same time was making sure that other groups were unprotected and unable to seek asylum in the U.S. But I'm also spending a lot of time these days working so I'm currently president of the faculty union at my institution, Rhode Island College, and we're working hard these days to rebuild support for public higher ed. You may know that public four-year colleges like mine that are really focused on teaching first-generation college students are getting killed by political leaders who don't seem to think that poorer students deserve access to a bachelor's degree and a four-year liberal arts education. And so, honestly, a lot of my work time is spent on that. And I want to mention maybe briefly that there is this national campaign now, the New Deal for Higher Ed, launched by the American Federation of Teachers and the Association of University Professors, and trying to, again, promote this idea that higher education is a public good and does require investment, you know, if we're going to make it work for our students and for our communities going forward. So my institution, Rhode Island College, just this month launched a new website, and I do have a faculty webpage, and I'd love it if people would check on that webpage soon. But I haven't had a chance to build it yet, but I will be updating it soon, and people can follow my work there going forward.
Well, we will definitely put a link to that on our website. And Eric, we want to thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder and for really helping bring history alive, but more importantly, the way that history has been politicized. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We go now to hear two poems by Raymond Nat Turner. The first is Justice Was Served. The second is called Essential Work.
Justice was served from warfare states' gas-lit walks. Justice was served, sweet and sour, in pepper spray soup, tear gas gumbo. Tears mixed with milk and milk of magnesia and crimson curry sauce, served from warfare states, walks on beds of rubber bullets / flash bang grenades. Justice was served on baton bruised ribs, golf ball sized wounds, contusions, abrasions, and platters of plastic cuffs, eyeballs, teeth, reconstructive surgeries. Rehabs on hunks of less lethal lies. Served on blistered feet, strained calves, and quads. Justice was served. Class struggle style from warfare states, gaslit walks. Stir fry served from massive motion stirred up from below, garnished with shoe leather, sautéed streets over the planet. Justice was served on shards of glass in street heat salad, served by bold, brave, creative young chefs aged in organizing, seasoned by marching months, succulent simmering from class struggle. Justice was served in sizzling black bean sauce, rainbow charred with white chocolate dessert, served by seasoned young chefs learning their craft, smelling fishy five-sided solutions, culinary coercion, young chefs learning to rock the wok with tantalizing takeout menus. Justice was served from the poison blue soil of the world's greatest purveyor of violence, served scoop flipped and framed with flimsy charges, served furtively from rotten orchards, one bad apple at a time. This piece is called Essential Work. We'll always need race car drivers roaring down streets where children chase balls. Like we'll always need peaceful protesters pepper sprayed like cockroaches. And we'll always need sleeping seven-year-olds shot while dreaming of dolls, sleepovers, tooth fairies. We'll always need children playing with toy guns in parks executed before becoming Hulk Hogan's. We'll always need doors kicked in and our daughters and sons slaughtered in wee hours, even if it is the wrong address. We'll always need elderly parents whacked for accidentally pressing emergency alerts. Like we'll always need mentally ill loved ones massacred in our homes. We'll always need men rushing pregnant wives to hospitals shot for speeding, and fathers of six hustling too hard, chokehold lynched. We'll always need young women who drive and smoke stopped and suicided, and mothers wearing masks wrong, wrestled down in subway stations as their four-year-olds watch. We'll always need wallets mistaken for guns, Glocks for tasers, fleeing black men shot in their backs, and bridegrooms butchered night before their weddings. We'll always need tasered hearts skanking in reggae rhythms and broken broomsticks rammed up men's rectums for fun. We'll always need bruised, bloodied, disfigured faces, eyeballs dangling from sockets. We'll always need drugs and guns planted, growing into cases, concertina wire, COVID-19. We'll always need right hooves raised, testifying to judges and juries of peers on the need for knees on necks, 56 licks or 41 shots served to protect property.
That was poet Raymond Nat Turner.
you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.